For opening words, I'm using some of the words from the Pueblo prayer that the choir will sing for us later as our call to worship. Hold on to what is good, even if it is a handful of dirt. Hold on to what you believe, even if it is a tree which stands by itself. Hold on to what you must do, even if it is a long way from here. I invite Susan Bowers, one of the co-coordinators of our AHA group, to light our chalice this morning. Susan and Roger Sanford share the co-coordination of our atheist, humanist, and agnostics group here at FIRST. As we light our chalice each Sunday, we remember that thousands of Unitarians who share with us this symbol believe it to be one of truth and freedom. Thank you, Susan.
My story today is from Haiti, and in the more southerly realms. You'll see by the main character that it's not from Canada. So Monkey was sitting way up high in a tree, and he liked being there. He had such a good view over everything. He could see the fields, and he could see into the forest. And as he sat there, he saw a woman come walking along from the fields along that path that led into the village. She had a great big calabash on her head. She was carrying something. And she was walking along, happy as could be, and, well, maybe she wasn't paying so much attention, because all of a sudden, oh, she tripped, there was a root right at the base of Monkey's tree, she tripped on that root, and she fell, and her calabash flew off her head, and it broke into 1,000 pieces, and all that sweet cane syrup that she had in her calabash, it started to flow all over the ground. The woman said, "Oh, misery, misery." She said, "Papa God, why do you give me so much misery?" And then she turned on her heel and she went home. "Misery? What's that?" wondered Monkey. So he swung down from one branch of the tree to the other, to the ground, and he could see all that syrup. And he thought, "Well, I'm going to try that misery." So he bent down just a little cautiously with one finger, and he took a, misery. It is sweet. And then he took his other finger just to make sure. "Oh, I like this misery." And so then he spent the next several minutes on the ground licking up every last drop of that misery. Oh, and you know, when he was finished, he wanted more. So Monkey climbed back up to the top of the tree. He'd heard the woman talking to Papa God, so he said, Papa God, please, may I have more misery?" Papa God said, "You want more misery?" "Yes, yes," said Monkey. "Misery is very sweet." "You're sure?" said Papa God. "Oh, absolutely." So Papa God said, okay. And he went and he got a big sack. He went and he got a big sack full of misery. And he said, "Monkey, you take this sack and you take it all the way to a place where there are no trees." "No trees?" said Monkey. "No trees," said Papa God. Okay. Well, Monkey could hardly wait. This sack was heavy. There was a lot of misery in it. Oh, and he walked and he walked. It took quite a while to get to a place with no trees. But finally, yep, here we are. Oh, he fumbled with the knot. It was tied pretty tightly. But finally, he opened the sack. And out came two dogs. They were growling and barking, and they immediately started to chase Monkey. They chased him all over the place. They chased him like crazy, and Monkey's heart was pounding. Monkey was feeling very scared. And just when he thought he couldn't go another step, there was a tree. There was a tree. Monkey scrambled up to the top of that tree. And Papa God said, Monkey, you need to work on your vocabulary. You gotta be a little more careful what you ask for. And so there's something for all of us to think about. What is it that we really want? Misery. I don't believe you. She wants chocolate. Oh. Well, what about last week? We had the little values auction. There was a certain value that went for $300. Friendship. Huh. That's what I'm going to ask for. Anybody else going to join me? Friendship? Friendship? Yeah. I think that's better than misery. We can talk some more about that in the back room. But let's form our arches and we'll process out slowly and gracefully.
As we move into a time of meditation, I'd invite you to open your hymnals to hymn number 391, Voice Still and Small, and we'll remain seated to sing this song, but we'll sing it twice through. But not yet. I have chosen this hymn, Voice Still and Small, because I love it. It says in words and music that what I experience when in really hard times. I absolutely need to listen to the terrible voices within me. I've been clinically depressed and hospitalized for depression many times in my life. These were experiences that I would never wish on anyone, but I know I'm not alone in having them. Bad mental health, which is depression for me, consists of deep emptiness, a total lack of interest in anything, and a wish for the end. Somehow, I have found that music comforts me. It even maybe makes me a little playful. Somehow, I've found that singing raises my willingness to keep on going. Somehow, I've been able to open to the dis-ease of others. Somehow, when I can connect with others who are equally ill or blissfully healthy, I can be spurred on to recovery. It's the connection that seems to count for me. Let us take a moment to remember our times of mental ill health and mental wellness. Breathe in deeply the healing energy of this congregation. Breathe out the concerns of your life. Breathe in, breathe out. Let us share a few minutes of silence together. Let us listen to our still small voice as we sing together hymn 391. Two times through. We're pleased to welcome Dr. John Pulley Blank this morning. He's a psychologist and a managing partner of the M. Jackson Group here in Victoria, which does rehabilitation psychology, assessment, and intervention. So he's involved with play and mental health.
Now, you can hear me, can't you? I got the Britney Spears headset on. Depending on how the wheels work on this thing, I could be joining you shortly. Greetings from Capital, and it's a pleasure to speak to you today. And so we begin. When I was young, it's likely my mother realized almost immediately that bringing me into her Sunday school class at our United Church was not her best idea ever. I think I've always been an atheist, probably fueled in part by my family's disagreements about religion. Reminiscent of my behavior in my mother's class, I later took a sociology of religion course in university, and given the wide array of choices for my paper, selected the Satanists. Now these people knew how to party, and their strong emphasis on sex found an attentive young student. Later, while working as an aide in a psychiatric hospital, I was pulled, urgently to the frightening ward for aggressive new admissions. The ward where men are men and little guys like me learn how to talk real fast. I was told that I was there that night because they had admitted two gods, two Jesuses. By the way, the spell checker just isn't going to handle that. And a Holy Ghost. And our task was to prevent them from encountering and smiting each other. As time passed, our family came to Beacon Unitarian, and a struggle began for me that I think continues to the present day. As an atheist not keen on churches, I had arrived at something that walked like a church and talked like a church, complete with hymnals, orders of service, facing forward, and a kind of dogma. While grumbly and careful never to sing God during hymns, I found over time, as perhaps a number of you have, a level of diversity that has multiple points of entry and all the liberals you could possibly want. I've been thinking about this and I realized that a Unitarian atheist gives up at least three things. The first is a potentially comforting mythology, often complete with a cool, though moody, omnipotent parent. The second is participation in a religion in the mainstream that people are more likely to actually have a clue about. Finally, depending on the kind of atheist you are, the third loss is the perceived right to get up in the grill of those with religious beliefs, as due to the Unitarian emphasis on tolerance. Over time in my atheist journey, I have heard about studies that looked at the relationship between religious belief and well-being, and frequently found that committed Christians in particular tended to be happier and to live longer. Not to begrudge them this good fortune, I found that I begrudged them this good fortune. And have often wondered about the parameters on this kind of finding. Well, here's our chance to take a closer look at this relationship. The paper I want to discuss today comes from a journal called The Counseling Psychologist. And it looks at American literature on atheism from 2001 through 2012. And broadens the examination of the relationship between religiosity and mental health. I should acknowledge right up front that the focus on the U.S. is both a limitation of this analysis, but also a source of fascination, given the severe strictures in the American situation. Try to get elected to an American office without regular references to God, for example. The article begins by noting that during the past decade, there have been a flood of pop atheist literature from authors such as Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris, and the late Christopher Hitchens. These authors are described as the beginning of a new atheism. Quote, a more militant, in-your-face kind of atheism marked by a drive to bring atheist discourse out of the shadows and into mainstream culture, end quote. So let's make a tentative attempt, perhaps brave attempt, to define terms. This paper offers the following quote. Defined loosely, religiosity refers to personal beliefs in a god or gods and organized or institutional practices and beliefs. Whereas spirituality is described as a belief in a higher power and or mystical experiences accompanied by less participation in traditional forms of worship, end quote. These two items are often confused. In the U.S., between 80 to 95% report having a religious affiliation and a belief in God. This contrasts with 4 to 15% of individuals in the U.S. identifying as atheist. However, this article points out that there remains no clear consensus on who atheists are and what they believe, or rather, what they do not believe. Recent literature suggests non-belief on a continuum that ranges from strong atheism, such as the informed decision to reject a belief in God, to weak atheism, such as agnosticism. Agnostics might have a view on that. There are other identifiers within non-belief, such as secular humanism, my people, defined in this paper as an ethical lens through which people are responsible for choosing their own destinies and live considerately towards others while being disinterested in issues of the supernatural, God, gods, or an afterlife. Sounds kind of familiar. You have to be nice to others as a humanist, too. Thus the title, humanist, rather than nananabubuist. As I alluded to, there is lots of research pointing to positive links between religiosity and or spirituality and the promotion of mental health and physical well-being, including improved prognoses for people suffering from cancer, HIV, and heart conditions. However, the authors point out, a tacit message in this research is that if religiosity and spirituality is linked to well-being, then a lack of such beliefs, such as beliefs held by people who identify as, atheist, agnostic, or just apathetic, must be linked to poorer outcomes. Some of this research has been challenged on methodological grounds, and it has been pointed out that this kind of assumption can be used by religious fundamentalist groups who are aggressively and unquestionably seeking control of the U.S. The paper spent some time on atheists as a marginalized group. This won't be the theme that I developed the most, but I do find it interesting. With a number of comparisons are made to LGBTQ individuals, including the idea of coming out as an atheist in an American setting. You come out as an atheist in the Canadian setting, and people just, whatever. Findings from several severe surveys indicate that compared to religious spiritual individuals, atheists are regarded by Americans as more troubling. I like that, more troubling. Many of you are troubling. Less moral, and not someone you want to marry into the family or lead the country. Bob's an atheist. The risk in the U.S. context, among other contexts we might think of, is that visible atheists will be marginalized and suffer the mental and physical health risks that have repeatedly been demonstrated as experienced by other marginalized groups, with the most recent discussion in Canada being around residential school abuse survivors. The author's search of the literature yields 31 articles that focus specifically on mental health topics such as well-being and distress. The most frequent religious groups studied, along with atheists in the studies, were Protestant Christians, Catholics, Jews, and Buddhists. So what were some of the findings in comparisons between atheists and the religious spiritual? I want to discuss 7 findings that I found particularly interesting. First, most of the studies that included both atheist and religious spiritual participants found no difference between the groups on measures of psychological well-being or distress. Secondly, what I have found to be a particularly interesting recurring finding was a curvilinear relationship between the certainty of people's belief, religious, spiritual, or atheist, and the dimensions of psychological well-being. So what does that mean in English? I'm going to try not to fall off the stage. So on this continuum, we're going to have religion, and over here we're going to have the atheists. They're going to be on your left. Now, to be on the left in a UU congregation, you really have to work at that. So the higher my arm is, the happier or more well-adjusted. There's lots of different variables that they use. The higher that is. So we've got atheists over here, and then we have roughly where the music stand is. We've got Christians. Okay. You can see they're separated. That's always wise. Okay, so there, what we find is committed, and you've got to be careful with that word, but yeah. Committed atheists are very happy across these studies. And what happens is the belief starts to wane or get a little bit more vague. We head into agnosticism or something along those lines. I can't prove it, so I don't want to believe that. And then we come down along here to eyeballs scare me, and maybe somebody made them, I don't know. And then we get over here, and, well, my family was always Catholic, but I don't want to be Catholic, but the Pope is kind of funky right now, so I don't know. And then we come up to, I'm a committed Christian, I have a clear belief system, I attend church regularly. These people are quite happy. And these are the ones the studies have been confined to, which is the whole reason for this paper, to take a look over here. So the curvilinear relationship kind of looking like a bowl. But curvilinear, you can bill more for curvilinear than you can bill for bowl. So people who are very religious or very non-religious tended to do better than people who are less certain of their religious beliefs, are spiritual but not religious, or who are agnostic. And I don't want to pick on the agnostics. I think it's a quite reasonable way to be, and I think the studies kind of blink in and out in terms of whether they're happy or less happy. I think the key is, and we'll talk more about this, the commitment to your belief rather than the nature of that belief. In one of the studies showing this pattern, people who were confidently religious or atheists reported greater life satisfaction and emotional stability than those who were unsurely religious or agnostic. It was noted that this pattern suggests that confidence in one's worldview may be more important for mental health than the nature of the religious beliefs themselves, which are the things we fight over. We will definitely return to this finding. A third study found no difference in depressive symptoms among Christians, Muslims, atheists, and agnostics. Fourth, one study compared atheists, Christians, and Buddhists, found similarities, in terms of well-being and empathy. Atheists, on the other hand, did score much lower on magical ideation. This particular finding was described as supporting the supporting the stereotype that atheists are logical, skeptical and nonconformist, but not as cynical and joyless as was previously thought. Cynical and joyless. I've never been so offended. I'll tell my gaming group about this. Okay, so the fifth one. One interesting study found that religious, spiritual Alcoholics Anonymous members were more likely to sustain their attendance at AA meetings than were non-believers. I think this is a key to a lot of issues, but that's a different homily. Sixth, a comparison of non-believing and religious spiritual individuals found no differences between the groups for well-being, satisfaction, or locus of control. The religious spiritual group in this particular study scored higher on meaning of life and had more social supports. Non-believers scored higher on the use of humor for coping. Again, just saying. Yeah, baby, if you can't be saved, be funny. I'm perplexed, though, by the locus of control finding. Locus of control is an individual difference in where you look for the origin of events. So those with an internal locus see themselves as making choices that lead to outcomes, while those with an external locus tend to see control as being in the environment or outside themselves. They wait for things to happen. Things happen to them, not by them. This would seem like a logical atheist-humanist internal locus versus theist external locus split, but some studies, I guess, did not find that. And I don't know why this is the case. Finally, one study looked at 88 atheists in palliative care. I'm sorry, I've been close to palliative care. It's nothing to joke about, but this title just gets me every single time. Let that wash over you. 88 atheists in palliative care. Like, worst title for a children's book ever. You think of responses like, wow, you're screwed. But the results were really, really poignant. Underneath the jokes, there's content here. So, moving on, this study found that participants wanted clinicians to respect their non-belief and not to force prayer or references to higher powers. They also, and this sentence is something, they also expressed a deep desire to find meaning, to maintain connections to important people, and to appreciate the natural world through their dying experience. Wow. The authors of the overall paper we have been reviewing discuss some limitations of this research and indeed the comparisons between what we call the religious spiritual and the atheist do raise a number of questions. First, it's noted that many or most of the comparisons made between atheists and, quote, religious people have involved participants who identify as Christian. This, of course, may obscure important differences, similarities and differences between atheists and other faith systems. And, of course, in any comparison between groups, there's more variance within the group than between the group. Second, there are a host of issues around the fuzziness in identifying whether someone fits into a particular religious spiritual group, or for that matter, groups plural. For example, one method is to look at church attendance as a determinant of religious belief. But one problem with this is that many individuals may attend religious services out of obligation, not actual faith. Third, I'm intrigued by possible next steps in this kind of research, such as looking at the role of different faith systems in times of crisis. I wonder if particular faith systems help or hinder coping in particular situations. In my case, a watershed was gallbladder surgery and general anesthetic. As an analog for death, being pulled into the dark with nothing more than a version of shit happens, was, as a belief system, was a test of my faith as an atheist. And frankly, it continues to rattle me a little bit. We do give up a great story as atheists. The religious alternative of another existence after death, with or without unlimited single malt, seems a little easier to face. So let's now return a bit to the curvilinear relationship, which frankly haunts me a little bit. I'm so busy over the years arguing belief views that the fact that we're all kind of happy is takes some adjustment. Again, participants who were either confidently religious, or firmly atheists had higher levels of well-being than those who were less certain of their religious beliefs. This recurring pattern suggests that confidence in one's beliefs and worldviews may be much more important for mental health than the content of those beliefs. Taken together in terms of psychological health, those who are firmly atheists look quite similar to religious spiritual individuals who are strong in their faith. Again, I find this finding fascinating. I wonder if across the landscape of beliefs, we create a kind of bowl of happiness. I'm going to copyright this. The rim represents those who are confident and comfortable in their various beliefs, and including their personal theology, and correspondingly experience the highest well-being. While the bottom of the bowl represents those who are less confident or comfortable in their beliefs and experience correspondingly less well-being. I think this relationship between commitments to beliefs and well-being raises a number of large and difficult questions. Let's just take a sample. From what does this well-being of certainty derive? Where does that come from? Well, a sense of meaning, just taking a shot here, one of the things we have spoken about in other homilies in Capital as important for resilience and thriving as people, including as when we get older. This certainly comes to mind as a mechanism. Do clear beliefs provide comfort and direction in an inherently ambiguous and changing world? Does tangible participation in the belief, like participating in a church, or implied participation, a feeling of belonging to a like-minded group, help the individual to feel connected to others, less alone, and generally on the right track? My reading since I last gave this homily has looked at judgment and decision-making, and I have seen how the coherence of our beliefs, the degree to which they tell a seemingly acceptable story, is a source of great comfort for us. In looking at Scientologists, a fascinating group, I found that the commitment to beliefs could provide comfort and the willingness to survive all kinds of privation created by the faith, unfortunately. Those who ended up leaving Scientology, on the other hand, described their beliefs as starting to tumble and their sense of well-being with them. Given the relationship between certainty and well-being, how do we understand fanaticism and extremism? Would we expect extremists to have such good well-being that they are euphoric? Well, I think that's quite possible for some. Alternatively, do some of the fanatical outer edges of belief operate by different, perhaps pathological rules than we have seen here, with comparisons largely between Protestants and atheists? Finally, if certainty of belief is related to greater well-being, is there a risk associated with a studious refusal to adhere to any one well-defined belief system or dogma, such as we see with Unitarianism? How do we explain the committed group before me and the diverse religious tapestry of their lives? Well, this is a huge question. In my small contribution to this, I think we come to what is the nature of our particular shared belief. Beliefs. We do not have a static dogma about how the world was created, although overall Unitarians tend to be rather fond of scientific explanations. Rather, we have more systems of thought that have change built into them. And this, to me, is key, a capacity to adapt to new information and new understandings as we continue to evolve in real time. It was in working on this homily that I came to understand the Unitarian principles better as providing the structure for an adaptable, not static or immovable, belief system that at the same time serves as a rallying point for liberal thinkers. I'm expecting that a commitment to Unitarianism will show the same strong mental health findings as committed believers versus non-believers. Unfortunately, in spreading the word about our particular faith, you do need folks with a degree of comfort with being outside of the mainstream. Just saying. In addition, being a UU is not so good for elevator speeches describing the faith, unless you have a very slow elevator in a very tall building. So decades of research have pointed to clear positive associations between levels of religious, spiritual, and mental health. But the findings from a host of studies does not support a simple belief that more religion is good and less religion is bad. There has not been meaningful differences between the religious, spiritual, and the non-believers on a host of domains, such as well-being, life satisfaction, locus of control, or empathy. As the author states, such findings parallel those reported in international samples in which atheists either score very similarly to religious spiritual participants on dimensions of psychological well-being or distress, or report less distress than those who are religious spiritual. So we're rocking it, is the executive summary. One purpose of this paper we have been discussing was to provide guidance to counselors working with atheists, so I will close with their guidance in that regard. The following quote is my absolute favorite. Counselors should avoid using reassurances that may typically soothe religious spiritual clients, such as, I have trouble even saying this, things happen for a reason, or events are all part of a larger plan. As such statements stem from religious spiritual faith. In contrast, atheist people tend to believe that they are responsible for creating meaning and purpose in their lives. Therapies that recognize this will be more likely to be effective with this group. Thanks very much for your time.
But first, some words from Mary Oliver. To live in this world, you must be able to do three things: to love what is mortal, to hold it against your bones, knowing your own life depends on it, and then, when the time comes to let it go, to let it go.